From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Australia's relations with Britain are presently in the spotlight on several fronts. Britain with the United States is a partner of the three-way security arrangement dubbed AUKUS, which was announced late last week. Meanwhile, on trade, the finishing touches are being put on the free trade agreement between the two countries that Scott Morrison and Boris Johnson agreed to earlier this year. And, most importantly, Britain has been applying pressure for Australia to increase its ambition on climate change for the November Glasgow Climate Conference. Vicky Tredell is the British High Commissioner to Australia, and she joins us today to talk about these issues. Vicky Tredell, does the AUKUS agreement represent a major new direction in British strategic policy, a shift back to the Indo-Pacific region after a long time?
Well, we have been very engaged in this part of the world for a very long time. And we have been looking at what we do once we leave the EU. And you may have noticed earlier this year, we published our integrated review, which set out our ambition for global Britain in the world, where we want to be by 2030. And very clearly set out in the integrated review was our Indo-Pacific tilt. Now, I've worked in this part of the world for many years now, having previously been Deputy High Commissioner in India, then High Commissioner in New Zealand with my cross accreditations to Samoa, and then most recently before this job, High Commissioner to Malaysia. So I do know and recognise how activist Britain has been in the Indo-Pacific. But what the integrated review recognised was the gravity has shifted to this region in terms of geopolitics, geoeconomics, and therefore we need to be part of this region, engaged with it. So in developing and delivering our strategy, it's looking at the engagement that we need, who our key partners are. So whilst this is a significant development, I would say it is part of a continuum. And of course, our relationship with Australia and the United States is a very long-standing and historic one. So it is an evolution, a strengthening, a deepening of that relationship.
And of course, the increasing assertiveness, indeed aggression, of China is obviously a factor in this thinking.
Well, for us, it is not so much that. It is about global stability and our engagement and how we work to be a force for good in the world. You know, China is an important country that we all need to engage with, not least in terms of the climate agenda. It is an important economic powerhouse where we have a lot of trade and investment interests with them. So we are looking at the systemic competition that there is in the region. We also want to play our part as a stabilizing force. And this partnership is very much part of that agenda, which is a much broader strategic agenda.
This wouldn't have happened without Brexit, would it?
Well, who can say? I think we would have been looking at how we strengthened and deepened our engagement in this region had we stayed in the European Union. I think what has happened with our departure, it has brought it to a sharper focus. But if you look at countries that are in the EU, this region is very important and everyone is raising their game. So I do think we would have done it regardless of leaving the European Union.
Now, France has reacted angrily against all the AUKUS partners, but in Britain's case, there's been a cancellation of some defence talks, and France has said that trust is missing from the relationship between the two countries. How seriously does Britain regard the French anger, and what can be done about it?
We are deeply disappointed at the reaction from France. We would hope that they will see the bigger picture, that our partnership from a strategic defence and security point of view should not be diminished. The areas where we already work with them, and likewise America and Australia too, all those things remain for us to work together on because they are important. Of course, they are disappointed at the loss of this submarine contract. The Naval Group was due to gain, on current cost estimates, a deal worth at 90 billion Australian dollars. But my counsel to French friends and colleagues is that we have so much more in common, so much more where we work together. That is where we need to keep a clear eye on the importance of our partnership and to keep a focus on that, because it matters that we keep our friendship tight. Obviously, they are disappointed, but I don't think they should regard it or interpret it as a loss of trust. This was a commercial deal. And it's not for me to comment on the Australian government's decision that it was not going to deliver the capability that they had hoped for. And as we all reassess what capabilities we need in this new world, where technology is moving ahead at such a fast pace, I hope that once things calm down and people look at the situation pragmatically, the way we work with France in multilateral and minilateral fora, our genuine commitment. If you go back to the integrated review that I mentioned, we make very clear in that first and foremost, Britain is a transatlantic country. Our commitment to the security of Europe through our significant investment in NATO is right up there. We are part of Europe's defence and security. We will not be resiling from that. Indeed, we are increasing our effort on that front. Our actions, our money, speak to the words that I'm making now. And I would encourage our French colleagues to look at that bigger picture, to look at that commitment that we have made, and actually to continue to work with us and our other partners in this endeavour, because there is a far more important strategic dynamic to safeguard, to ensure stability and peace in the region.
Nevertheless, this was a failure of diplomacy. Did Britain and the United States err in leaving too much to Australia to smooth over things with France, to prepare France for this announcement?
No, I do not believe there was a failure of diplomacy. This was first and foremost a decision by the Australian government, which we supported. And rightly, it was for the Australian government to lead that engagement. We are, of course, reaching out to France in our own right now to see how we can work with them and reassure them. You know, we have had a long-standing and historic relationship with France, and indeed this group of allies, where they are so upset with us at the moment. We have recently had the anniversary of the Battle of Britain. If we look at, you know, in recent years, the events around the centenary of the First World War, the events of the Second World War, there are the bones of Americans, Brits, Australians, and other allied forces in the war graves across France and Europe. That is our commitment, and that is the sacrifice we have made for the freedoms that the whole of Europe and the world enjoys. So it is important to remember our history and our track record of always being there in the defence of France.
So has there been any conversation between your Prime Minister and the French President in the wake of all this?
No, I don't believe they have spoken, but obviously we are engaging at the most senior levels possible. Our ambassador in Paris, who's well known to friends here in Australia, Menna Rawlings, and her team are busy reaching out into the French system. So, you know, I think we were all surprised by the reaction of France. We would encourage them to look at the situation and the points that I have made about the greater strategic importance of returning to a sense of confidence in our relationship with each other.
Let's now turn to trade before we get on to the climate issue. Is the trade agreement between Britain and Australia now done and dusted, or are there still a few things to be negotiated?
We are pretty close to concluding negotiations and finalising all the chapters. Work is still underway to achieve that. We hope within this month, early next month, that will be concluded. As you know, the agreement in principle was secured back in July when Prime Minister Morrison met Prime Minister Johnson in London just after the G7. That set out the broad framework of what we agreed on, and our negotiators have been busy pinning down each element of the detail in order to deliver on that. So we have a little bit more work to do, but we are on our way to conclusion. And remember, of course, that this will be an important international treaty with a lot of technical detail. So getting through that process does necessarily take the time that it needs to take in order for it to be a robust document.
Britain has applied to join the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact, and China, we also learn, is applying. What's Britain's attitude to that Chinese move?
We think the CPTPP is an important trade bloc, and the more people who engage with it, the better, because that is one way to genuinely open up international trade. So it is not for us, as our accession is not complete, to comment on other countries. The existing members of the CPTPP will decide who will join and whether or not they meet the criteria for joining. So rightly, China must pursue its own agenda with the CPTPP countries. We, meanwhile, will concentrate on our own accession and indeed the work that we need to do to secure that accession.
Let's now turn to climate change. What does Britain hope to be the result of the Glasgow conference in November?
Well, for us, we want to see high ambition from all the countries participating in COP26. We see this as a really important economic agenda for the world, the economic transition that we need to make. But in making that as part of our race to zero, is that the ambition must keep within sight 1.5 degrees of global warming. This is the only way that our world can survive, and the green industrial revolution that needs to take place for that to happen, to create the jobs of the future, the new energy sources that we are all going to need in this coming century. So our Prime Minister has made it very clear, and if you look at the statements overnight and in the early part of this week from his participation at UNGA, we are looking for high ambition from all countries on setting targets for net zero by 2050, more ambitious NDCs and interim targets by 2035. You know, for us, we have to walk the talk ourselves if this is what we are encouraging other countries to do. You know, for the Paris Agreement, achieving its goals means limiting global warming, as I've said, to 1.5 degrees. And the reason why we press for targets, because it's a key means of measuring that we will be on track for the 2050 ambition. For ourselves, we have reduced emissions by over 50%, whilst growing our economy by 78%. And we have set ambitious targets for ourselves of reducing emissions by 68% by 2030 and up to 78% by 2035. So those are things that we are doing, and we are asking all nations to raise their ambitions as we have. No one is saying it's easy, it's going to be tough. The transition and the innovation and the delivery of new technology will require investment. This is why the business agenda, engaging with business and industry and the private sector, who will help to drive this and the delivery of this, is absolutely essential.
Just remind us, what's Britain's position on coal?
Well, you will have seen the G7 declaration by the G7 countries called Powering Past Coal. We would like to see the phasing out of all coal-powered power stations in time for 2050. So there is a sort of 30-year time frame. We know that economies need to transition, but that is an important part of the agenda, that if we know there is a time frame, how do we bring in the alternative energy sources? How do we bring in the new industry that will be vital in order to deliver that? And, you know, Boris Johnson, our Prime Minister, has a great way of distilling things into a few key words. What he has said is that we need urgent progress on cash for climate finance, on cars to transform the automotive industry, and on coal and on trees, replanting, returning natural habitat. That is all critically important as part of this agenda.
You mentioned his speech, your Prime Minister's speech this week at the United Nations. Let me quote that speech. He said, "When most of the world has committed to decisive, game-changing action, it will be clear to all which of us has lacked the courage to step up." Is Britain optimistic that Australia will substantially step up? And does Britain want it to significantly boost its medium-term ambition as well as to embrace the 2050 net zero target for the Glasgow conference?
We are looking forward, genuinely looking forward, to working with Australia to grow and innovate new technology solutions. As you will know, we have signed a technology partnership agreement with Australia. And my Prime Minister has made it clear that he is encouraging all countries, including Australia, to set ambitious science-backed emissions reduction targets, not least because that is important to create the certainty that business and industry and investors are looking for.
But do you think Australia will make a substantial commitment, especially in the medium term?
We remain hopeful that Australia will. I know that Prime Minister Morrison is working hard towards this, but we do understand the politics of Australia. And all we can do as good friends and partners is to encourage and to say that we will be there to work with Australia to realise that level of ambition.
And there are talks this week between Boris Johnson and Scott Morrison, both of them being in the United States. Do you think that Boris Johnson will be again strongly pressing the climate message on Scott Morrison?
Yes, he will. I think he raises it and they discuss it every time they meet. You will remember when they met in Downing Street at the press call afterwards. Boris Johnson said very publicly, looking at Prime Minister Morrison, that he hoped and expected Australia to meet that target ambition.
Today, the UK partnered with the New South Wales government to host a meeting of leading members of the Australian business community to discuss climate action. Do you think the business community here in this country is way ahead of the government?
I think the business community is doing what the business community needs to do. Every business is considering their own future and their own transition towards net zero. Shareholders and stakeholders are demanding it. Any company that operates internationally is finding in the other jurisdictions in which they operate that the regulatory environment, for example, in those countries requires them to be able to deliver. So, you know, we work in partnership with business and industry. The event today was a call to action, encouraging companies who have yet to make that commitment to join our Race to Zero initiative. And the best way to do that is not for a government official like me to advocate it, though indeed that is my job, but to hear from the voice of business themselves. We had a fabulous panel with Dale Connor from Lendlease, Shimera Wickramanayake of Macquarie Bank, and Frank Calabria of Origin Energy, explaining to the business audience why this matters to them, why it makes business sense, what they are doing, from practical tips and advice to transition their companies, the things they are doing within their businesses. And one of the very strong messages that a number of them made was that their own employees are looking to them to do this. And this has become as much an internal dynamic as much as it is to seize the opportunities that are out there in the new global green economy. So having those business voices explain why they're doing this gives huge credibility to the economic argument. So we are seeing more and more businesses sign up. But the key message too was, in doing this, businesses need to have a plan, need to have timeframes, what are their own targets that they're trying to meet in order to realize that ambition, and actually the value they get out of it in terms of their business success. And Lendlease now, as part of their brand, is as a green construction company, and they win contracts on the basis of that. And a great example was that when they started to make this transition, the average cost of a zero emissions construction was about 20 to 25% more than a conventional building construction. They have seen, with their supply chain transforming, the cost drop right down to 5% more. And within 5 to 10 years, they forecast that green buildings or green constructions are likely to be cheaper than conventional or traditional built environments. And importantly, too, the ongoing costs of running buildings where you have new technology, new materials, is that you will save on your energy costs and your overheads. So those are examples from the business community of what is working for them and where they see the business opportunity in the future.
And while there are lots of opportunities from going green, as it were, there are also costs, aren't there, if Australia as a country doesn't step up, because there are dangers that we might be faced with tariffs, we might not attract investment or as much investment. What are the risks, do you think, of tariffs being imposed on us if we don't do enough?
Well, there is that risk if some countries decide to bring in ways to deal with carbon leakage, and where they have a concern that they need to create a level playing field for all producers in a climate-safe economy. So the UK has not adopted a formal position on a CBAM, but it is not currently, because it's not currently a UK policy. But we are committed to ensuring that all countries have ambitious emissions reduction targets, and where you do, and industry and business transforms, then that threat falls away. You know, my view is that Australia has a huge opportunity to become a global leader in, you know, key clean industries of the future. Australia has an almost unparalleled opportunity to create jobs and growth domestically, and also to produce the key inputs needed for economies around the world to decarbonize. Inputs like clean hydrogen, green materials like steel and aluminium, and indeed the critical minerals of which you are rich here, like lithium, needed for growing clean technologies. So this is, if we're thinking of an elevator, this is the ground floor. This is the best place to get on board in order to rise and realize that potential. You know, we estimate that annual trade in low carbon goods and services is expected to grow from the current Australian dollars, in 2015, to about $5.8 to $9.7 trillion by 2050. Now, who doesn't want a share of that, you know, mega trillion market of the future? By 2050, green hydrogen could supply up to 25% of the world's energy and be a $13.7 trillion global market. Now, Australia has backed hydrogen, so there is a huge opportunity to develop that as the alternative fuel of the future, or one of the alternative fuels of the future.
On the costs, though, even if Britain doesn't have the policy of imposing any sort of retaliatory measures on countries, some European countries or the European Union as a whole could do so. Is that right?
Well, they could. If that's what they adopt, it will be one of the measures, which I know is something that your government doesn't want. But the best way to avoid that is not to find yourself in a position where you will be subject to any such tariffs were they to be introduced.
Is it high risk?
It's hard for me to say because, you know, Australia is committed to technology transition. So there is a race about transforming our economies. It's the same race that Britain is in at the moment, because that is the best way to mitigate against that risk.
Just finally, you mentioned earlier Australian politics on this issue of climate. It's interesting, isn't it, that a Conservative government in Britain is so strong on climate change. And indeed, years ago, Margaret Thatcher was an early warner about the need to tackle this issue. It's been very different in Australia, and we've had the climate wars, which you've avoided. How do you account for that difference? How have you been able to not get into this very negative debate about such an important issue?
Well, our context and our history is different, but I think the key thing was it took political leadership. And as you say, starting with Margaret Thatcher, I was a young junior diplomat when she attended the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Malaysia in 1989. And I remember her making speeches about the environment, our ecosystem and climate. And successive British governments of all political persuasions have found that they have carried public opinion and indeed been driven by public opinion on this, that on climate we have a genuine bipartisan approach. What is interesting is the recent opinion survey here in Australia, where it is clear that there is a majority of Australians who want to see greater ambition and action on climate. It may well be that we're moving into an era where the conditions are right for ambition and a bolder position on climate.
Vicky Tredell, thank you so much for talking with us today in the run-up to what's going to be a very important conference and in the wake of a very significant security agreement. And that's all for the Conversations Politics podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.